Welcome to ASAP Nowcast with our medical editor-in-chief, Dr. Cedric Dark. In this episode, he'll be speaking with Dr. Anthony Cirillo live from Washington, D.C. and the ASAP Leadership and Advocacy Conference.
I am with Tony Cirillo, one of our ASAP board members, and we're here live at LAC 21, which is our Leadership and Advocacy Conference, one of my favorite conferences to come to every year, because we usually get to go down to D.C. and Capitol Hill and talk to our members of Congress. Unfortunately, we won't be able to do that in person, but we will be doing that virtually this year. So welcome. Thanks for joining me. I told you, this is one of my favorite conferences. I'm assuming it's one of your favorites as well.
Yeah, this is definitely the highlight of, for those of us who are the political geeks in our groups, this is definitely the highlight of the year for me.
We haven't done this. We missed it last year because of COVID.
We did.
So we're back in person with masks. Everyone's checking their, you know, well, we're not checking our temperatures, thank goodness, but we're at least checking, making sure no one has symptoms and all that. So have you noticed any differences between last time we did this and now?
Yeah, there definitely is a different feel, but I think it's an appropriate different feel, right? I don't think any of us are going to go back to the way things were without acknowledging how difficult the past 16, 18 months have been. Look, it's affected all of us, and I think as much as we've been affected, I think all of us who believe in this conference and believe in the power of our collective voices wanted to be here. And I'll say kudos to the ASAP staff who are trying to make this experience as safe as possible. We are socially distanced. Most people are wearing masks. We're doing health screenings. So I think we're trying to make it as good an experience as possible.
Sitting in the audience, to me, it looked pretty packed in terms of we didn't see a huge drop-off in numbers. But at the same time, like every table, there were just two people at a table. So there's a lot of elbow room.
Yep. So I would say typically, I think an average a meeting would probably be 500 attendees. And I believe as of this morning, we had 360 here. That's a great number. And I think it speaks to a few things about why this conference, particularly this conference, was so important. And one is your voice is still important. Whether we physically go to the Hill or whether the Hill visits are virtual, I think we'll still have the same impact. And we've seen that over the past year plus, where members of Congress and their staff are very used to now meeting with constituents by Zoom. So it's not anything new to them. It's how they do business. And I think for many of us, we've realized it's a more efficient way to have those meetings. So I would say that for those people who said it's not going to be the same, it won't be the same, but I think it's still very important. The other aspects of this are it is the first time ASAP we are getting back together as the family. And I think many of us miss that interaction with our colleagues, the ability to just hear, how's your family doing? All the little small talk that doesn't happen with a Zoom meeting, because the Zoom meeting ends, the business is over, and then we all go on to the next Zoom meeting. This is about a little bit of, I think, restoration and a little bit about reminding ourselves and reminding each other how much we value each other. So I think so far it's been great. I think it's wonderful that we're able to do this.
Well, excellent. Well, let's get down a little bit to the content. You're going to provide a recap for everybody in an upcoming issue of ASAP Now, so that's great for those that weren't able to be here. You'll be able to read about what happened, but we'll talk about some of the issues that are going on and some of the sessions that have already taken place, as well as some of the ones that will take place a little bit later on. So, one, solutions for the opioid crisis. We had a panel earlier this morning. What is ASAP doing in regards to the opioid crisis?
Yeah, first of all, I would say we've been successful. We used to have to do the 8 hours of training to get the X waiver. And for a brief period of time there, we thought we were completely free of all of that requirement stuff. And then the registration part came back. And now what we're fighting for is to say, look, there are still, I think the number from the conference this morning is there have been 500,000 overdose deaths, 93,000 in the last year. We still have a huge issue that we own to the extent that these people come and we either save them or they die in our department. And then we deal with the aftermath of families and communities. So we are fighting, and part of one of our three issues now to go to the Hill with tomorrow is to get the X waiver registration requirement removed. There's no reason why I should have to register to give one particular drug to help patients. I don't do that for any other drug. So that's our top of the list, is to remind Congress, you got to get that waiver off, because the registration part, because it's still something that gets in the way of every emergency physician being able to take the best care of a patient with SUD.
So if someone wasn't able to attend, they hear this, what would you tell them to do in order to get to that for us as a college?
I think as we go through the top three issues, we could do that now. The top three asks from the college while we're having these Hill visits is, number one, is to get the Lorna Breen Healthcare Provider Act passed. For those of you who don't know, Dr. Lorna Breen was an emergency physician in New York who developed COVID and then took her own life. And we've been able so far, ASAP, together working in collaboration with the other medical specialties, has gotten funding for improving the care, the mental health care of healthcare providers. And actually, HRSA just announced they were releasing $103 million of that grant money last week. But the Lorna Breen Act contains even more, and we really would like to get that passed. So that's first ask. Second ask is about removing of the registration for the X waiver. And the third ask is, we're talking about the fiscal cliff that's coming with the release of the recent Medicare fee schedule for 2022. Here's the numbers for emergency medicine. We are facing a potential 9.75% cut on our Medicare reimbursement. Cedric's eyebrows just like went, what? Last year, and I know we're jumping ahead into the conference, but these are the three issues that you're going to call your member of Congress. Let me help you. Here's what we're going to ask you to do. Those of you at home should call your member of Congress. And if you're home, you can call their district office and you can say, hey, look, I want to speak to someone about these three issues. They may refer you to the DC office, that's what they often do, but it gives you another point of contact with your member of Congress, and every touch point with a member of Congress or their staff is critically important to you becoming a valued asset to them and a trusted person who will talk to them on issues. So here's the ask to you. For those of you at home, when you hear this, you're gonna call your member of Congress and say, hey, I know ASAP is on the Hill, or they were on the Hill. I'd like to talk to my member about the issues that my colleagues talked about while they were there.
All right, that's some great advice for people listening, especially talking to your members back in the home district, because you know what, they actually listen to people probably even better when they're from the home district, in the home district, because they don't get inundated with calls like they might in DC.
Good point.
All right, another thing that they talked about earlier this morning was human trafficking. Big issue that's difficult, I think, for physicians to recognize and deal with. Kind of like when we were talking about child abuse, yes, back in the elder abuse, things, yeah, like that. So what did you learn from that session today?
Yeah, I think it's one of those, there are times when you put your head down a little bit and you go, I'm not as good at some things as I should be. And you go, I think I know I need to learn more about this. I need to be better. As Cedric said, I think we've gotten more comfortable and we got technically better at recognizing child abuse and technically better at recognizing elder abuse. And we're very comfortable being mandated reporters about that, because I think we own the fact that I may be the only person between that child being abused again and help. So I think for the trafficking, I think the message is, hey, this is a problem. It's a more difficult problem because it's not as visible sometimes in terms of a wound or a bruise or a fracture on a child. But you got to put your radar up all the time, and you have to be willing to stand up in defense of that person.
Staying vigilant is number one.
I think becoming more comfortable with what are the subtle things to look for. I think anytime we become clinically more comfortable, whether it's in cardiology or orthopedics or whatever, when you feel like you really know the topic, you become much more comfortable to call the consultant, if you will, and say, hey, here's what I have, because I've recognized it, because I clinically know exactly what this is. I think with trafficking, the more you become comfortable with what are those subtle things that you put them together, and all of a sudden you go, okay, I know what's going on here, you then feel more empowered to make that call to say, I'm going to step in.
All right, excellent. Then we had a session on telemedicine and talking about expanding what we do, the reach that we have as emergency physicians, into the virtual realm.
Yep.
So what did you get out of that, and what do you think emergency physicians back home should be doing?
Yeah, I think that COVID has been an evolutionary moment for a lot of the way we deliver medicine. And I'm old enough, Cedric, to remember when the Jetsons were on, when they weren't on Cartoon Network. And I have a slide that I use in a lot of my presentations about advocacy when I talk to residents, and it's a picture of Elroy Jetson getting a telehealth visit in 1968. And I said, it only took 52 years in a pandemic for government to say you can do telehealth and actually get paid for it. Kudos to Judd Hollander and the folks from Avera eCare and the folks from Jefferson, who have been, you know, the voice out in the wilderness on this for years now, saying, hey, we can do this. My pitch to all of you as emergency physicians is this. Look, the world is going to continue to change. We might not have another pandemic like this, but the opportunity for the specialty to evolve and for emergency physicians to say, what's really important is not where I am and the patient is, but that I get the chance to use my brain to evaluate that patient. we all know that most of figuring out what's going on with the patients is the history. And so you can do a lot of evaluation of people. And immediately, what I think our unique skill is to decide who's sick and who's not sick and who needs something else right away. Whether I'm the medical director for a paramedic service that's now part of the CMS ET3 program, or whether you set this up on your own, I think the opportunity here is for us to evolve and accept that the specialty is about taking our brain and evaluating patients, sometimes in the brick and mortar ED, but maybe wherever they are, and that's still emergency medicine.
All right, so we've got telemedicine from the Jetsons. I think we have our house cleaning robot, which is a Roomba. We need the flying cars now.
And you need the dog. You need Astro.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, yeah. All right. And then the thing we had before lunch, the lunch break, was the EM Workforce Report, which is a great panel with representatives across the spectrum of emergency medicine representing many different interests. And this is one of those things that I think, as we look 5-10 years down the road, is going to be a big issue for emergency medicine. So what can you take away from that as to what the college needs to be doing and what our members need to be doing, looking at where emergency medicine will be in 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, so first of all, the presentation, Ed Salzberg, who's from GW, who has done workforce studies for a lot of medical specialties, did an overview of the report that came out in April. And I think Ed did a great job of walking through, so how did we get to the number at the end of the report? Because for all of us, we know that the conclusion in the study is only as helpful as when you understand the methodology and what the limitations are and what the strengths of a study and the weaknesses were. So Ed walked everybody through that. And then I think the panelists who are here, Fiona Gallagher from CORD, Louis Ling, who has worked at the ACGME, RJ Sontag, the president of EMRA, and Mark Rosenberg moderating this, I think it was to get to have a conversation. And this is an issue that's always going to be an issue. It's always been an issue. I think it's become more painful for a lot of us in terms of COVID has exposed. I think the frailty of the specialty. Look, we're a very volume-dependent specialty, right? When the volumes go down by 40%, that changes how we can practice. Regardless of what size group you're in, regardless of how your group is structured, 40% reduction to every group of any kind was something that we went, wow, how will we get through this? What if the volumes don't all come back? What if telehealth now replaces some of our brick and mortar volume? So I think COVID has become that evolutionary moment where we get to say, what do we want the specialty to look like 5-10 years down the road? And then the workforce should follow that. So I think they did a great job of having a discussion about this. I know that in the report, we tried to walk away with, I think, two concepts. One is, this is not just an ASAP issue. And although ASAP is ASAP, and for those of us who have made this our specialty of our organization of choice, but this is an emergency medicine problem, if you will, or issue. So CORD has a role, the academic chairs have a role, SAEM has a role, EMRA has a role, because no one of our organizations has the authority to make some of the changes that we all believe may need to be changed. So there is a collaborative ongoing conversation between the leaders of those organizations to have that moment of, okay, so what do we really want to do and who owns that? And then the second part is we have to look at supply and demand and really focus on the number of residents that are coming out, how to ensure that residents who come out are appropriately trained. I think to look at the appropriate role of non-physician providers in the ED and what they've been trained to do and what they should be credentialed to do based upon that training and perhaps not just on licensure. And then on the demand side, I think, again, telehealth has created one opportunity for us. But I would offer there's some amazing opportunities for us to take ownership of the patients that come to the ED when there is no other solution. And sometimes people go, but that's not what I signed up for. But I have a passion about taking care of patients with mental illness. And one out of every 7 patients who comes to an ED today is presenting with a primary complaint that is mental illness, psychiatric emergency related. Look, we can say that's not our job, but those are still our patients. And we can either be frustrated that nobody's really fixing the system to take care of them, so they're not in the ED for days or weeks. Or we can say, we're going to take ownership of that. So I think there are opportunities in mental health, in substance use disorder, for us to just accept nobody else is going to fix this. Rather than being frustrated by it, it can create huge opportunities for those physicians who are emergency physicians who have a passion about other issues.
All right, thank you. One of the next things that is being talked about at LAC 21 is health equity. And I think it's something that the emergency department, we're better than every other specialty at dealing with issues like this, because we see every patient, no matter who they are, how much money they make, how much insurance they have.
Green, blue, yellow, red, we don't care.
We take everybody no matter what.
Well, a long time ago, before your time, Larry Bedard, when he was president of the college, had his slogan for the year was no shirt, no shoes, no sanity, no. And he didn't, it was basically a way to say, to your point, we're the ultimate health equity provider because it doesn't matter to us.
So how do we go further? What do we do next?
Yeah, I think part of that, though, is much like the issue with patients with mental illness and patients with substance use disorder, where it sounds nice to say we're going to have health equity. And I know there are policymakers and legislators who are focusing on that. But ultimately, we own when it doesn't. And so it's nice for those people to talk about that there needs to be a solution. But ultimately, when there isn't a solution, it falls on us. So I would tell you, I feel empowered by that. Yes, it's frustrating, but nobody gets to tell the stories of here's why the system is broken and here's what really would fix it. I think sometimes policymakers want to fix a problem without really understanding what is it that I really need to do to make this better. And not really just for us, although I will tell you, I think it would make careers less stressful and more rewarding, but really for the patient. So when we talk about mental illness, having mobile crisis teams so that the patient gets mental health care at their home when they're having a crisis and never have to interact with law enforcement or the healthcare system that really is not the fix to what they need at that moment. Those are the kind of things where we could say, look, that's what you need to do. If you're going to invest in those solutions rather than investing on back-end solutions like building more spaces in the ED for patients who are waiting for psychiatric beds to board, you go, well, that's not the right solution. So I would say we should be empowered by the opportunity to continue to tell policymakers where the system is broken and what we know will fix it, particularly when it comes to health equity, because those people who are less advantaged, their voice needs to be amplified, and I believe we can be the amplifier of their voice.
And that all starts with us telling our stories. And I want to use this as an opportunity to mention to all the listeners and the readers of ASAP Now, give us your stories, because what you contribute to our magazine is what we're able to tell the world about what we do in emergency medicine.
I think that's a great point, Cedric, because the power of our specialty is just that, is that we are the ultimate, we are there all the time. I've been doing this for 30 years now, so I feel the frustration, and I know it gets harder every day. But I think, again, I would tell you to be empowered by that, because it's only if hundreds of people, hundreds of you sent in your stories about pediatric psychiatric boarding and how bad it is and told those stories in a HIPAA compliant way, but told those stories, we could take that whole compendium and go to Capitol Hill and say, this is why you need to fix this. Here's 100 stories of kids who were essentially, I hate to say it, but incarcerated. Right? In a 9x9 room with nothing sharp and no edges, and they can't go even outside for basic exercise for days or weeks. I mean, and I gotta tell you, it takes a part of my soul away every time I see that. And another thing, if you're walking around the department and you're physically avoiding that area so you don't have to make eye contact with the mom or dad, those are guilty steps. They don't count on your Fitbit. So keep that in mind.
All right. Again, we're going to be talking about reimbursement.
Yep.
You mentioned that before. There's a huge cliff coming up for EM reimbursement. So if it wasn't bad enough that we had, you know, our pay cut or our hours cut because of COVID, yep, we're facing another financial hurdle, yep, coming up from federal government.
Yes. So part of the challenge is that the way the Medicare system is set up is that on the provider side, and this is something we are making more noise about with policymakers, on the provider side, there is this concept called budget neutrality. So every year when the Medicare budget is set for providers, basically it's a food fight between all of the specialties. And the ring that gets adjudicated in, for the most part, is called the RUC, the Relative Value Update Committee, which is overseen by the AMA, where every specialty is represented. And basically, though, if you think about it, sometimes we add new procedures, right? For all the ultrasound stuff that we've found we can take better care of patients with, those generate a CPT code, which means now there's more things that need to be paid for. So basically, the RUC becomes that place where everybody gets to, there's give and take. of how much I should get for my codes versus how much the orthopedist get and all that. When all of that work gets done, then Medicare can divvy up that pie based upon how much weight was given to everybody's services. But the challenge is that it's a fixed pie, and so there are winners and losers. Last year, in the middle of the pandemic, emergency medicine would have taken a 3.75% reduction in Medicare payments, which often then become the standard for what happens on the commercial side, which so it gets that effect gets exponentially grown. But we would have taken a 3.75% cut. Congress, because we were in the middle of the pandemic, basically gave a one-time dispensation of that and basically said, we're going to cover the budget neutrality costs this year by taking money from the Social Security Trust Fund. That had not happened, and that was a one-time event. Now the proposed schedule for 2022 comes out, and guess what's back there? The CMS goes, hey, remember that money that Congress said we didn't have to take from you last time? It's back in now. So there's a 3.75 reduction potentially coming on January 1st. But there's also two other things that we're facing. When they pass the first COVID reconciliation bill, there is a concept here in DC called PAYGO, which means if you're going to spend money, you're supposed to find the money to spend it. And under the rules of PAYGO, we would take another 4% cut. And then there's another goofy rule down here that we all hate called the sequester. So back in 2013, when the government was going to shut down because they couldn't agree on a budget, one of the ways they passed the budget was to say, we're going to take a 2% off the top on things like Medicare payments to providers. So you throw all that together, and basically what we're facing on January 1st is a potential 9.75% reduction in our payments for Medicare, which would be unsustainable, and we're still in the middle of a pandemic, and we're still getting beat up by this whole thing. So that's one of the battles that we are now going to fight over the next 6 months, is to protect reimbursement to emergency physicians who are still standing in the front line in the middle of a pandemic and trying to convince legislators not to make that happen. I think the bigger fight that we now need to fight, and I reference that it's only the provider part that doesn't get any change each year. For hospitals and for skilled nursing facilities, they get it almost like an inflationary update every year. So they get more money every year from Medicare. Their part of the pie gets bigger, and the provider part doesn't. And that's inherently unfair, and we're going to start making noise about that. So what we'll need you to do...
You call your congressman.
When you got them on the phone, you go, hey, by the way, it's inherently unfair to be taking money away from emergency physicians who are still standing on the front line of saving the nation in a pandemic. And that whole system is broken and has to stop. That's the message.
Great. One of the things I'm looking forward to is Social Congress, the perceptions and use of social media on Capitol Hill. Yeah. See if all these tweets that people send out actually mean anything.
So your voice matters. And I think part of this talk will be is that social media is a part of that. And I think social media can be helpful, but it can be hurtful as well. And what I would suggest is that one of the things to think about is how can I, for whatever you're passionate about, is how can you spin a positive message? Everybody knows what the problems are here, particularly in D.C. and in every state capital and in your hospital. Everybody knows what the problems are. So honestly, tweeting that there's a problem is not exactly breaking news. But tweeting that you're interested in being part of a collaborative solution, that actually starts to get traction, because then people say, hey, that Cedric Dark person, I saw what he tweeted. He's a guy who understands that there, we have to find a way forward. Those are the kinds of, I think, social media posts that honestly help us move towards a solution.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Cirillo, for joining me today. And if you are listening to this now, and if you happen to miss LAC, you can just type in hashtag LAC21. You can see all the stuff that happened and photos from people at the conference, points of educational pearls that people picked up from our speakers. And look for, in an upcoming issue of ASAP Now, Dr. Cirillo's recap of LAC21.
Thanks, Cedric. Appreciate it.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the hosts and any guests. The music is Florence Price's Fantasy No. 1 in G minor for violin and piano. Thanks for listening.